Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 10th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:16 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Fields, Representative Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff, and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. We have a lot to go through on today's agenda since last week we didn't get a chance to have a meeting. Let the record reflect that Representative Prox has joined us at 3:17 p.m. First, we're going to hear House Bill 60, a bill at the request of the governor. My intent for this bill is to hear and hold it for a future date. Second, we will hear House Bill 112, a bill from Vice Chair Ruffridge. My intent for this bill is to hear and hold it for a future date. Third, we will be discussing House Bill 87, a bill by request of the governor that my office is working on a new committee substitute for. My staff will explain the changes, the summary of changes for that bill, and answer questions that members might have. My intent for this bill is to discuss changes and hold it until Wednesday, giving members a chance to get any amendments they have in before the deadline at 1 p.m. on April 12th. Then we will have public testimony on House Bill 86, a bill by request of the governor. My intent for this bill is to hear public testimony and hold it over until Wednesday when we'll be discussing potential amendments. Starting with House Bill 60, will the bill sponsor please approach the table, put their name on the record, and begin.
Good afternoon, Chair Sumner. For the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health.
And for the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Family and Community Services. So HB 60 is a continuation of doing some minor cleanup of the Executive Order 121 that went into effect July 1 of 2023. Executive Order 121, as you know, reorganized the Department of Health and Social Services into two new departments, the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. When we were going through the executive order process, we said at that time that there would be some minor statutory changes that may need to be made in the next legislative session, and that's what HB 60 is intending to do. These are pretty minor changes, but they are important changes for the departments to be able to continue their operations to serve Alaskans. First, the bill accomplishes making sure that the Department of Family and Community Services can share information with the Department of Health. And this is the same work that we have been doing as we were in the Department of Family and Community Services. This allows us to share that important, sometimes health information, so that we can serve Alaskans. Second, this adds the Commissioner of the Department of Family and Community Services as a statutory advisor to the board of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. This was one of the substantive changes that needed to happen under a bill versus through the executive order. And lastly, this clarifies in statute licensing duties assigned to the departments. The former Department of Health and Social Services was licensing runaway shelters. Under this cleanup, this specifies that the Department of Health is responsible for regulations and licensure, while the Department of Family and Community Services maintains and registers licensed runaway programs, awards, grants, and receives notifications related to minors. And with that, I'm going to pass it to Ms. Carpenter if she has additional comments.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health. I have no additional overview comments, Chair Sumner, but I'd be happy to walk through a sectional analysis if that would help the committee.
Yeah, go ahead. But let the record reflect that Representative Wright joined us at 3:19 p.m. You can go ahead. Thanks.
Okay. And again, for the record, Heather Carpenter. Section 1 is part of that technical change, correcting a mistake in EO 121 where we mistakenly assigned the licensing duties of runaway shelters to the Department of Family and Community Services. This part of statute is the National Criminal History Record Checks for employment and licensing. It's part of the background check process that our Division of Healthcare Services does, and we send fingerprints over to the Department of Public Safety. So that is why we're touching public safety statutes. And this just clarifies that we are removing runaway shelters from Department of Family and Community Services and making that more precise. And as Deputy Commissioner Leslie said, runaway shelters are actually licensed to the Department of Health. Section 2 is amending AS 1865F1 to just amend the definition of department to refer to the Department of Family and Community Services. Section number 3 is adding the Commissioner of Department of Family and Community Services as a statutory advisor to the Mental Health Trust. And that would go along with the Commissioners of Health, Revenue, and DNR that are already statutory advisors. Section 4 is the section that would set out that expectation and requirement that both departments are sharing identifiable health information or personal health information known as PHI to the extent necessary to conduct businesses between the two departments. I want to point out that both departments remain HIPAA-covered entities, and all of our employees are required to go through annual HIPAA training. This is really important, as the Deputy Commissioner clarified, to share information so individuals are, nothing is delayed when we're working to get somebody placed. A couple examples of how this happens in real life is if we're coordinating on a youth patient who may be in the Office of Children's Services custody, but receiving acute psychiatric care at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, but who needs ongoing outpatient behavioral health care that is funded through the Medicaid program and may also have a home and community-based service waiver that touches senior and disability services. So that would be 4 different divisions and 2 different departments, and we regularly have that kind of coordination. This would also be coordinating with youth and adults of all kinds of complex care that are receiving services in both departments. And another practical example is assisting in an outbreak of disease at one of our pioneer homes or one of our DJJ facilities, and our Division of Public Health section of epidemiology may be providing technical assistance. I'm going to bulk together sections 5 through 9 and 11 through 14 because those are effectuating the changes that we discussed about clarifying the oversight and licensing of agencies of programs related to runaway minors. The executive order incorrectly identified that oversight and licensing agency as the Department of Family and Community Services. These amendments correct that mistake. And as the Deputy Commissioner said, Department of Family and Community Services is helping with some coordination, and they're maintaining a register of licensed runaway programs where the Department of Health is actually licensing those said entities. Section 10 is amending 4710.386 to clarify that any records required by both of the departments that are held by licensed shelters for runaway minors are considered confidential. And Section 15 is in our licensing statutes, and it is just clarifying, since both of our departments now have pieces of these statutes, it's important to be precise and reference which statutes belong to which department. So Section 15 clarifies that foster care licensing specifically belongs to the Department of Family and Community Services, who is already doing that work. Sections 16 through 18 also go together, and they all make it clear that both departments are involved in the licensing of programs. The executive order really failed to capture this nuance, and we wanted to make sure when people are reading statutes that may be looking for who is licensing them, that it is clear which departments have that. And these are all changes to AS 4732, which is the centralized licensing statutes. Section 19 is in the definition section of the centralized licensing statutes. And this section is amending a reference that adds the Department of Health in the definition of assisted living home to just be more precise. Section 20 is also in that definition section, and it adds a definition for applicable department. Section 21 repeals the licensure of runaway shelters from the Department of Family and Community Services and finishes up that cleanup I described earlier. And finally, Section 22 establishes an immediate effective date.
Thank you. Do any committee members have questions? Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. I know many of us heard this bill before and has. Why is this bill in Labor and Commerce? Am I missing something? Thank you. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Fields. It's a great question. Originally, when this bill was introduced, the speaker gave it two committees of referral, one to the House Health and Social Services Committee and one to Finance. But because there is a zero fiscal note, the Finance Committee was referral was removed and Labor and Commerce was added.
Got it. Well, I'm glad it's in a safe place. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? No? Okay. Seeing none, we will set this bill aside for a future date where we will have public testimony available. Moving on to House Bill 112 from Vice Chair Ruffridge. Representative Ruffridge, please approach the committee table, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation. I understand you, yes, you have Ashley Shaver, Chair of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy Online, to present information and answer any potential questions that committee members may have.
Do.
Okay. Well,
thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, Justin Ruffridge, representative from District 7. Thank you to the chair and members of committee for hearing House Bill 112 today. For the profession of pharmacy, I will just give you a brief introduction and then pass you off to Dr. Shaver, who is online to go through the slides. House Bill 112 is a multi-year, multi-chair process that has been gone through by the Board of Pharmacy at the request of the governor for right touch regulations. So the Board of Pharmacy, through three chairs, the current chair, myself in my time as chair, and then the chair right before me, went through a large regulation rewrite of pharmacy regulations. The pharmacy profession has undergone a lot of changes over the course of the last 20 to 30 years, went from being a bachelor degree or an apprenticeship program to now a doctorate degree program, capable of doing clinical work, prescribing, as well as dispensing prescriptions, and a lot of other things in between, compounding, hospital care. It's really been quite a change that has been produced in the profession. As a result, we needed some updates to our regulations. Through that process, we noticed that there were a number of areas that our regulations could not be adjusted without statutory change. And rather than continuing to come to this body with every little tiny change, we just kept note of all of the things that we thought needed to be changed in order for those right touch regulations to continue to be produced. And this is the culmination of that event. So it is a relatively lengthy bill, but it's mostly cleanup language. In addition, it adds one component to it, which is the ability for pharmacists to prescribe epinephrine or EpiPens, as some of you may know that as, and gives the board authority to regulate epinephrine training programs in order for pharmacists to prescribe and dispense those items. I'm certainly available to answer questions prior to the presentation, or I can stand for questions after as well.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I used the term twice, right touch regulations. I'm not familiar with that term. Could you please say what that is?
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this was a it was an initiative put forward by Governor Dunleavy to update and alter over the course of his tenure as governor our regulations with what he would call the right touch. So regulate what needs to be regulated, but don't overregulate. Also clear up any sort of regulations that may have been outdated or unneeded at this time. So essentially how I took that to mean in my time as chair was read every regulation and answer the question, do you need it, yes or no? And that's what we did.
Thank you.
And then I do have my staff here, Braden Garrett, who's available for the sectional if that is the will of this committee as well.
Go ahead, Mr. Garrett.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Braden Garrett, staff to Representative Ruffridge. Section 1 amends AS 0808010, subsection A, by designating one member to be a licensed pharmacy technician. Section 2 amends AS 0880030. Primarily, the main thing in this section is to add an epinephrine auto injector training program, and the other subsections are cleanup language. Section 3 amends 0880145 to remove internship details, and the rest is also cleanup language. Section 4 amends AS 0880157 to add out-of-state pharmacies and manufacturers to the list of entities that must be licensed and inspected, which was previously only registered. Section 5 amends AS 0880159, to update to comply with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act. Section 6 amends AS 0880159 to add pharmacy and manufacturer to a list that may be inspected. Section 7 amends AS 0880160, which removes the word registration for the above statutes. Section 8 amends 0880168 and adds a new subsection that allows a pharmacist to administer epinephrine to a person or prescribe epinephrine. Section 9 amends AS 0880270 to allow the additional salary range and allowing flexibility for the division to select a pharmacist for the role. Section 10 amends AS 0880420 by adding the term apothecary to the list of those that cannot be used for advertising. Section 11 amends AS 1262400, adding pharmacist and pharmacy technician to a list of professions where a background check is required. Section 12 amends AS 1722010 to allow anyone over 18 to purchase or be prescribed an epinephrine auto-injector. Section 13 amends AS 1722020, subsection A, allowing the board to adopt standards for the epinephrine auto-injector training program. Section 14 amends AS 1722020, subsection B, to allow the board to approve an epinephrine auto-injector training program. Section 15 amends AS 1722030, stating that the chapter does not apply to someone authorized under law to administer epinephrine. Section 16 amends AS 1722040, outlining that a person may not be sued who administers epinephrine who has completed the epi auto-injector training program. Section 17 amends AS 1722090, definitions of the board, which defines the board as the Board of Pharmacy. Section 18 repeals AS 0880110, subsection 2, which repeals two affidavits attesting to the applicant's good moral character, which is not currently a requirement in medical board, dental, or nursing statutes. It also repeals 0880158, the registration of pharmacies, and requires licensure. It repeals AS 1722020, subsection C, which is the department's epi auto-injector, their current training program. And then it also repeals AS 1722090, which defines the department as the Department of Health. Section 19 is transitional language for currently registered pharmacies. Section 20 is also transitional language regarding regulations. Section 21 provides an immediate effective date. And Section 22 outlines that effective date being set to coincide with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act.
Thank you. And then we have Mrs. Schaber online. Would you like her to begin her presentation right now?
Please.
Mrs. Schraber, I think if you're on, you can begin your presentation now. Thank you.
Yes, this is, for the record, my name is Ashley Schraber. I am the chair of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. I've been practicing as a pharmacist and an Alaska resident for over 15 years here in Anchorage. and I appreciate the opportunity to be here, Chair Sumner and members of the committee, to tell you a little bit more about House Bill 112. So I believe you'll be changing the slide for me. I'm on teleconference. So we'll go to the next slide, which is the Alaska Board of Pharmacy Strategic Plan. So currently, our Board of Pharmacy has 7 members, 5 are pharmacists, and 2 are public members. And as Representative Ruffridge mentioned, the board has been working hard over the last several years to make regulation changes, to align with a Right Touch regulation project. And many of these changes are needed to allow the regulation changes to go into place. Goal number 4 of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy Strategic Plan is to grow the economy while promoting community health and safety. And many of these changes were born out of strategies related to that particular goal, specifically reviewing effectiveness of regulations that reduce barriers to licensure without compromising public health and safety, 4.4, advocating for licensure as the pharmacy profession evolves and new opportunities for new improved patient safety arise, and 4.5, anticipating changes to the Drug Supply Chain Security Act and responding proactively. So we believe these changes in House Bill 112 will align with the Board of Pharmacy Strategic Plan and the mission, which is to promote, preserve, and protect public health and safety and welfare through effective control and regulation of the practice of pharmacy. And so we'll go to the next slide, which is a little bit more background on House Bill 112. And as Representative Ruffridge mentioned, these are changes that have been the result of a multi-year, encompassed multi-boards of pharmacy, multi-shares. And when we look at the changes, they can really fall into 4 different sections. So we've got those sections outlined in this slide. Streamlining the license process while improving public safety, compliance with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act, alignment with other professional boards, both here in the state and other pharmacy boards in other states, and then clarification of pharmacists' role in the in epinephrine access. And I want to point out here that this has been a collaborative effort between the Alaska Board of Pharmacy and the Alaska Pharmacists Association, and both do support the House Bill 112. Next slide, please. So the first goal is to streamline the license process while improving public safety. As the sectoral analysis reviewed, part of this bill is eliminating unnecessary forms that are currently redundant, and those are required in statute. The bill is also clarifying that only pharmacists who dispense controlled substances are required to register with the PDMP. Currently, those pharmacists have to fill out an exemption form, which has to be processed by the division. So this should streamline some of that work. Also, the safety component here is adding a national criminal background check. This is required in 30 other states, and it's also part of the Model NABP Act, so the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, which is the standard. We recognize that pharmacy technicians and pharmacists handle controlled substances, and the board feels that a national criminal background check is an extra measure of protection to help ensure the public safety for Alaskans. Next slide, please.
Mrs. Shaver, it looks like we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Through the chair, is it Mrs. Shaver or Dr. Shaver? I want to be respectful. If it's Dr. Shaver, you referenced unnecessary forms. I guess I'd just like to ask, what's a couple of examples of what kind of forms we're speaking of?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the forms that we're speaking of are, they are the moral affidavit forms. And so currently, pharmacist applicants must fill out 2 of these. They have to be completed by 2 citizens and completed and processed by the division. Moral character is something that is required for the division to assess in other areas of the license process. And so it was determined that these forms are redundant and not necessary. They're not required in the medical board, the dental board, and the nursing board statutes. So we felt like that was a way to streamline the license process without compromising safety.
I thought I heard form as I was thinking to the chair that, you know, some kind of just a paper form. This is actually a requirement or a standard or something. This is not just the form itself. It's actually eliminating unnecessary qualification. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Great question.
Is that the only
one? So for the record, this is Ashley Saber, chair of the Alaskan Board of Pharmacy. The next goal is to comply, to allow the Alaskan Board of Pharmacy to comply with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act. This is a federal piece of legislation that is in place to secure the U.S. drug supply to help prevent harmful or counterfeit medications from entering our supply chain, to also help detect harmful drugs if they do enter and enable rapid response if medications such as this are found in the supply chain. And as we've learned more about this piece of federal legislation over the last several years, we've realized that boards of pharmacy play a key role in the process, and that really is through appropriate licensing of drug distributors, manufacturers, and pharmacies. So the changes in this bill allow the Board of Pharmacy to appropriately license and inspect these entities that are providing services to Alaskans. We also are adding on here clarification that internet pharmacies need to be licensed as well. It was not clear, and we were finding inconsistencies. So this does give the Board of Pharmacy the statutory authority to license internet pharmacies to ensure that Alaskans receive safe medications.
Dr. Schaefer,
next slide, please.
I believe we have another question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Dr. Schaefer, harmful drugs. Is this like adulterated drugs or that are out of date or the drugs that have been previously approved by the FDA but then later found unhealthy? Is it fentanyl? Help me understand what harmful drugs includes.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Sadler, it could be a combination of those. We've seen where counterfeit medications that are misbranded or mislabeled and they don't actually contain the medications that they are labeled to contain. We've seen those type of medications enter the supply chain. So that really is what we're trying to prevent here by ensuring that Alaskan pharmacies and Alaskans ultimately receive medications that have a clean supply chain or a clean pedigree. So we know each step of the way where that medication has been during the supply chain.
Thank you.
All right. So for the record, this is Ashley Saber. Moving on to the next slide, which is alignment. And the goal here is to align the Alaska Board of Pharmacy statutes with other boards in Alaska and other states. So the first bullet here replaces one of the two public member seats with a pharmacy technician seat. As Representative Ruffridge described at the beginning in the introduction, we've seen an evolution of our pharmacy profession, and pharmacy technicians are playing an increasing role in the practice of pharmacy and assisting pharmacists. So we've seen many other states add a pharmacy technician seat to their board to ensure that their perspective is considered when regulating and overseeing the practice of pharmacy and public safety. The next goal here is to allow the board to adopt language for retired pharmacist status. So currently, if a pharmacist completes their career here in Alaska, their option when they're finished with their career is to let their pharmacy license lapse. In many other states and also many several other professional boards here in Alaska, a professional can opt to retire their pharmacist license or retire their license, which would give them a little bit more recognition to the career that they've completed. Also, you do see several boards that allow for reinstatement of a retired pharmacist license a little bit easier than a new application. So we wanted to align the board with that language. The last goal here is a clarification for the board executive administrator salary. The board wanted to have flexibility to hire a pharmacist into the executive administrator role in the future, if one should apply and be qualified. We found that over 50% of other states either require or already have a pharmacist in their executive administrator role. We're seeing more and more complex pharmacy needs and feel that this could be a benefit to the board moving forward. The board did not want to require a pharmacist at this point because we recognize that other individuals with different qualifications might also be able to fit this need. But we also wanted to be competitive in reimbursing a pharmacist if they were to be or to apply for this position. And then the next slide here is epinephrine access. This bill is moving epinephrine training program to be underneath the Board of Pharmacy. It's previously underneath the Department of Health. And it does clarify that a pharmacist can administer epinephrine to a person or prescribe an epinephrine auto-injector to someone who has completed the training program. Ultimately, this increases epinephrine access for Alaskans who have either known or unknown anaphylaxis emergencies. And it's very similar to the model that's already in place, allowing pharmacists to prescribe an opioid overdose medication such as naloxone. And that is what we're seeing in other states. It does align with a couple other states in terms of increasing epinephrine access. And so the last slide here, I just wanted to respectfully request your support of House Bill 112, allowing the Board of Pharmacy to further promote, preserve, and protect public health, safety, and welfare of Alaskans by and through the effective control and regulation of the practice of pharmacy. And I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Dr. Schaber. Are there any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or Dr. Schaber? No? Okay. Seeing none, we will set House Bill 112 aside for a future date where we will have public testimony. Brief issues. Okay, we're back on the record. Next, we have House Bill 87, a bill by request of the governor. Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 87, Work Order 33-GH1337/S, as our working document.
Okay, without objection, the committee substitute has been adopted as a working document. My staff, Jesse Logan, has been working on the new committee substitute. I will have him come forward, put his name on the record, and explain the changes. Mr. Logan, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jesse Logan, staff representative Sumner. Members of the committee, you'll find in your packet, of course, the CS and also a summary of changes. And there were so many changes to this, I felt it easier to understand, so I built a chart rather than a narrative. One of the reasons is that this bill was, like all or most governor's bills, was drafted by the Department of Law, which uses a different drafting manual than our attorneys. So you'll see in some of this, like the third item down on the chart, Section 3 from the original bill is now Section 7 in the CS. Many of the changes are conforming to the drafting manual. However, I will go ahead and talk about some of the substantive changes. Sections 1, 2, and 5 from the original bill are only slightly reworded, but the intent is the same. Section 2 is included in that. Section 3, let me back up for a second. This original bill was drafted by the governor's office to give some extra exemptions for allowable absences to still qualify for the dividends, and also to give background checks for the authority to do background checks for certain members working for the permanent fund. Those things remain the same. We have added extra exemptions. You'll see in Section 3, The governor's bill allows merchant mariners attending qualified vocational programs to qualify for an allowable absence for eligibility purposes. We included, and this is now Section 7 in the CS, that is all the same, and we included NOAA and Public Health Service. So instead of seeing armed services as allowable absences, you see uniformed services. So commissioned officers from NOAA and Public Health Service can qualify for those allowable absences. In Section 4, from the original bill, it defined the terms of education on a full-time basis for purposes of calculating allowable absences. These are students that are attending school out of state that might not come back for, lengthy periods of time as they're in full-time educational programs. This is now Section 7 of that bill. Continuing on, Section 5 is already included in Section 1, is now in Section 11 of the new bill. Section 6 is from the governor's office. We did not change any of this, and this allows notice of levy for individuals who are subject to court orders for writ or for collection of debt to be notified electronically. And Section 7 and 7, 8, and 9 are transitional languages and immediate effective dates. Now, on the third page of your summary of changes are the new sections that were added in the CS by Representative Sumner's office and the committee here. The most substantive one is Section 2. Section 2 of the bill removes the traditional formula for determining the net income of the permanent fund for purposes of calculating the amount available for appropriation. Now, traditionally, this amount available for appropriation had only ever been used to distribute the permanent fund, but for several years now, we have had a percent of market value in the books that we use to draw on to help pay for state services and also to pay for the dividend. The section retains the languages for a 5% POMB average market value draw into the general fund, and the amount available for appropriation cannot exceed the balance of the earnings reserve. This is fairly boilerplate. Section 3 now states the legislature may appropriate from the ERA to the dividend fund 50% of the amount available for appropriation. So this will be a 50-50 split between the dividends fund and the POMB for state services. Section 5 clarifies, these are very boilerplate stuff, clarifies that the state versus Emerita Hess money is not appropriation or available for appropriation to the dividend fund or inflation proofing or the mental health trust fund, but can be deposited annually into the capital income fund. Section 6 clarifies that the net income of the mental health trust fund may not be included in the computation of the amount available for appropriation. Section 8 provides a definition, as I mentioned before, for uniform services that includes NOAA and public health services. Section 9 adds an extension, a grace period, if you will, for dependents of Alaskans who experience a medical emergency that prevents them from filing by the March 31st deadline. And Section 10, language, it just basically clarifies the amount of the dividend is an appropriation rather than a transfer, which is something that I think a lot of people have wanted to clear up for a while. And Section 13 is applicability. I'm happy to walk through the sectional analysis, but I think that it pretty much covers all of it.
Okay. Questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid I did not get this, the chart that Mr. Jesse was, Logan was reading through. So you referenced Section 9 and so forth. I assume that's under the CS, but I don't see a Section 9 or 10 in my chart. Am I missing something here? Were you referring to the old section?
There is. It's not in order. There is the first two pages are changes from
the. I got two pages, so.
Oh, there should be a back page. Oh, my apologies. I'll get that to you.
Yeah.
Actually, you can have this one right here.
I just want to see where it's going to go. Thank you. Yeah, didn't have that. So.
We can take a brief at ease. The record. Does any committee member have questions? Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you mentioned, actually I didn't catch my note quick enough to say which section, but you mentioned some section of this that clarifies that it that the funds should be transferred from the ERA to the dividend fund by an appropriation as opposed to an automatic transfer.
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Prox, it has been in statute since the early 80s as a transfer.
Right.
However, to the best of my knowledge, the Permanent Fund Corporation has always viewed it as an appropriation. And Wilikowski versus the state, I think, further clarified that in the Supreme Court. But we do have the division director online, Genevieve Witusik, if she wants to answer that question or if you need further clarification.
Well, no, I guess we'll move on. For purposes of this bill, I suppose that makes sense. But there was some interest in correcting the, I won't say correcting, that's not the right word, changing the constitutional language to clarify that this could be transferred by a statute and didn't need an appropriation.
Well, and if I might, Representative Prox, that would require a constitutional change. Right now, with the Supreme Court decision, it is an appropriation.
Yes. Okay. I guess I'll just have to think about that.
I'll dive in.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Logan. So I'm looking at the new sections contained in version 7 of HB 87 CS on page 3. It says the third bullet point under section 2, this one here, just for easier reference, says this bill would make it so that the amount available for appropriation cannot exceed the balance of the earnings reserve account. So that's a potential significant limitation in the size of the dividend. Is that, am I reading that right?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's actually standard language that's already in the statute.
Sure, sure.
And that just makes sure that we don't overdraw the earnings reserve.
So through the chair again, so if it's, I'm sorry, it's this is a change or this is existing law? Having not dived into this, I'm asking some obvious questions. Sorry.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, the part that says that it cannot be more than the balance of the ERA is existing law.
Okay, it looks like it says this is a substantive change, so I'll just delete that. Okay. Yeah, I, before I can ask intelligent questions, I'm going to have to read through it pretty carefully. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fields.
I'm in. Let's move it.
Okay. Well,
I actually do have a joking aside. I appreciate the chairman's work on this. And just wanted to bring to the attention of committee members, I'm drafting an amendment that would establish a rebatable income tax equal to the size of the permanent fund dividend so that we would have a structure where higher income families would pay an income tax that would equal the dividend. Lower income families would not. Non-residents as well as residents would pay this tax. So, you know, getting it drafted so people can review it. It's not actually my idea. But happy to include it in here if people think that is conducive to the broader discussion of a fiscal plan with revenue elements.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Fields. I'm not quite sure I heard you properly. You say you're proposing an income tax bill to be added into this legislation?
Through the chair, I've requested a draft and actually I think just got it back during this hearing in which we would establish an income tax that would be equal to the annual permanent fund dividend, but it would only apply to higher income earners.
Right.
And basically the concept is, you know, appropriating a dividend of up to 50% of income available. We don't have enough money to do that right now. There are a bunch of ways that we can raise revenue. Most of my constituents are more interested in funding services than dividends, and the higher income ones are happy to give up their dividend to fund services. So my conceptual, well, it's written down now. My amendment would effectively do that and in effect be a wealth transfer from higher income to lower income individuals. And I guess as a kind of ancillary issue would have the benefit of capturing some revenue from high-earning out-of-state workers. So
right.
I just wanted to raise that to committee members' attention so they can think about it heading into amendments.
Representative Sadler.
So follow up. So through the chair, Representative Fields, you're going to propose an income tax as part of this bill. Is that correct? That's looking for affirmative or negative?
I'm I'm happy to bring it forward, and I'm going to defer to...
That's affirmative, right?
Well, actually, I was raising it as kind of a group discussion, if people think that's a positive element of the bill. I've gotten it drafted so people can review it, and, you know, people can... I guess it's a decision, do we simply update the formula here, or do we also bring into discussion new revenue since the formula is written in the CS? We can't afford it yet. And I'm happy to defer that revenue discussion later, or do it now based on what people want to do.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. For the record, I heard yes. Thank you.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Fields, could you define high income, like, in terms of your bill?
Yep. As drafted in the amendment, $75,000 for an individual and $150,000 for a two-income family.
Thank you.
Following up to the Chair, Representative Wright, I mean, there's a bunch of different ways you could craft an income tax. This one is very simple. This one's designed to be zero net tax on your higher earners, but retain the full permanent fund dividend for your low earners. So it's very simple. There are more progressive ways to structure it, but I wanted to keep it simple and ensure that no Alaskans net pay an income tax. The tax would not exceed the PFD.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the Chair to Representative Fields.
And Representative Ruffridge, if this is also pertaining to an amendment that is not before us yet, I prefer that we hold that discussion until we have amendments before us. And certainly, we'd love to see everybody, you know, that wishes to bring forward an amendment, bring forward an amendment, but would also like to see those amendments move before we debate them.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I will withdraw my request for questions.
Okay. Thank you. Do any committee members have any further questions pertaining to what is before us?
Pertaining to what is before us, yes, I guess. I'll let you decide. I, too, have a bill that pertains to the, well, maybe not, just the dividend. Is reserved to relating to the criminal, or maybe that doesn't fall under that. I think we're going to have to hold on to this for a while to see how it fits into everything else that's going on. Well, and I, yeah, because I'm in disagreement on whether the Constitution, what we meant what we said in 1976. And then the Supreme Court thought we meant something else. And that needs to be discussed and maybe clarified. Okay. That's beyond this.
Thank you, Representative Prox. We will set this bill aside for a future date where we will have public testimony, and we will set an amendment deadline for a future date. Okay, moving on to HB 86, a bill by request of the governor. We heard this bill a few weeks ago, and we'll be having public testimony on it today. DBS Director Rob Schmidt is available to answer questions if needed, and I guess I'll run through a real quick synopsis of the bill just to refresh committee members' memories. The bill repeals the current law that requires currency exchange businesses to obtain a license from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. It establishes a new law that requires money transmission businesses to obtain a license. It defines money transmission as engaging in the business of selling or issuing payment instruments, stored value, or receiving money or monetary value for transmission within or outside the United States by any means. It defines virtual currency as a digital representation of value that is used as a medium of exchange, a unit of account, or a store of value and is not legal tender. It requires money transmission businesses to register through the nationwide multi-state licensing system and registry, the NMLS, a web-based platform that streamlines licensing processes for state regulators and applicants. It sets forth the application requirements, fees, and conditions for obtaining and renewing a money transmission license. It allows money transmission businesses to appoint authorized delegates to conduct money transmission on their behalf under certain terms and conditions. It requires money transmission businesses to maintain a minimum net worth of $100,000 plus an additional amount based on their outstanding payment instruments and stored value obligations. It requires money transmission businesses to maintain permissible investments equal to or greater than their outstanding payment instruments and stored value obligations. It defines permissible investment in investments as cash, bank deposits, certificates of deposit, government securities, money market funds, or other assets approved by the department. It requires money transmission businesses to file annual reports and quarterly reports with the department through the NMLS. It requires money transmission businesses to keep records of their transactions for at least 3 years. It authorizes the department to examine, investigate, and enforce money transmission laws and regulations. It authorizes the department to cooperate with other states in regulating money transmission businesses. It establishes civil penalties and criminal offenses for violation of money transmission laws and regulations, and it provides for an effective date. So, we will go ahead and open public testimony on HB 86. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify? Okay, I see none. And online, looks like we have a Mrs. Peacock from Nome. Mrs. Peacock, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. That's actually
Excuse me. Peacock.
I'm one of the owners of Quiana Card. We're based in Nome, Alaska. We're Alaska Native-owned businesses, and we provide basic banking services for rural Alaska villages that do not have access to traditional banking services. We support, you know, H. Bill 86, and primarily the sections in it that have to do with reducing regulatory burden and the fees for money service businesses such as ours that are, you know, much smaller than, let's say, Google Pay or Facebook Pay and these other large money service businesses that are regulated. I think the best way I can explain why I support this is a story from our first bank examination. Based in Nome, as I said, we had our examiner fly to Nome. There was no, you know, doing it over the phone to reduce costs. And flew to Nome, stayed there for a few days, and we were required underneath the current statutes to pay back all airfare, lodging, car rental, and every hour that they were on working on our exam. When she arrived, the examiner, she said she just returned literally from California from examining Google Pay. And at the time I just started this business, I really wasn't familiar with what we were getting ourselves into, and I was shocked to find out that we were on the same playing field as Google Pay. Every fee, every annual document, every quarterly document, exactly the same. And so, you know, we support it primarily because not only just for the barrier to entry for any money, small money service business wanting to get started in Alaska, but in particular in rural Alaska. You know, there's very few of us, you know, trying to start small businesses out there. And this type of regulation and the barrier to entry, you know, we're on the same playing field as a Google Pay for the same bond requirements, you know, like I mentioned, all the paperwork requirements and all the annual fees and things like that. It's just, you know, almost too much for us to continue to stay in business. So that's primarily why we support this bill. We hope you'll support it too. And that's all I have today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peacock. Any questions? No? Okay. Representative Prox might have a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Peacock. This is a little bit beyond my expertise, but you said that you're operating a bank with a money transfer service. Am I understanding that correctly?
Not per se a bank, but underneath the current statutes, we are considered a money service business, and that's because we provide a reloadable prepaid debit card in the villages, but they are able to walk into their local stores that we partnered with and deposit checks and money orders that then we put immediately onto their bank debit card so they can, you know, shop there in the community, purchase Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. We don't provide loans and things like that. So we're not, I think, underneath the exact banking examinations, but underneath the MSB license registration. So, yeah.
Follow up?
Go ahead, Representative Prox.
So then you currently are under banking regulations, and this would clarify that you're not a bank. Is that a fair statement?
I'm not sure if it's a fair statement. We are underneath the Division of Banking Securities. You know, we, who we're under, who we fall under for all of our examinations. And, you know, maybe a representative from the state can, you know, clarify, you know, exactly that more. But, yes, we're required the Division of Banking Securities, you know, to do bank examinations. I assume, you know, very similar to what all the big banks do. I just know from our experience that, you know, these licenses underneath the money service business are similar to a lot of these other money transmission businesses, whether that be prepaid debit cards, you know, like a, I don't know if you've heard of like Netspend cards and things like that, or these Visa prepaid cards, and then also money transmission businesses like, you know, Facebook Pay or Venmo and Google Pay and all those types of businesses. So I don't know if there's a separation specifically between those types of businesses and you know, I wanted to say National Bank of Alaska, I sourced them, Wells Fargo and First National Bank, as far as, you know, what the examinations detail. But.
And, okay. Representative Prox, we do have, it appears, four people online from the Division of Banking and Securities. Should you want to ask them a question?
I want to save it for them. Thank you.
Okay. I will close public testimony. Oh, is there? Oh, we will reopen public testimony. I didn't see that. Oh, I apologize. We have an Adam Flesher from Money Services Roundtable in D.C. Go ahead, Mr. Fleischer. Put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sumner, for reopening. My name is Adam Fleischer. I represent a money transmission trade group called the Money Services Roundtable. Our members are some of the larger money transmission companies in the United States, companies such as Western Union, MoneyGram, and American Express. The Money Services Roundtable supports HB 86 because the Money Services Roundtable supports and worked on the development of a Model Money Transmission Modernization Act, which is what is the sort of underlying form of law that informed the drafting and the revisions to the Alaska Money Transmission Law that we see in HB 86. The idea behind this model law was that money transmission companies, both small local money transmission companies and national money transmission companies, could be more effectively and efficiently regulated if money transmission laws in each of the states across the country were more uniform and harmonized, and also modernized to reflect the nature of money transmission services today. Now, I'm sure that some questions will be held or addressed by the banking division, but money transmission companies are not banks. They do not have, they're not chartered, they're not depositories, they can't store and take deposits of customer funds the way banks can. So it's a more limited, if you will, permission. But they're still able to provide a significant amount of financial services to customers, and often in locations that are not served by traditional financial institutions such as banks. And so with this money transmission law, and as you implemented here through HB 86, the one of the good things about this law is that it scales, if you will, the size and nature of a money transmission company. It recognizes that the risks and the concerns related to companies that have significant amounts of volume are more significant than with respect to smaller shops, and therefore it imposes higher standards, particularly with respect to prudential standards such as surety bonds and the amount of required net worth on the larger money transmission companies. So that's why the roundtable, the Money Services Roundtable, is supportive of HB 86. We feel the common regulatory baseline, the regulation of money transmission across the country, is a crucial step really for better and more efficient regulation of money transmission companies, big and small. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fleischer. Any questions? No? Okay, so we will, seeing nobody else, we will close public testimony. Is there any questions from the committee for any of our banking gurus that are online? No? Okay. Oh,
there is
Representative Brox.
Yes. I'm still trying to clarify as best I can in my mind the difference within this statute between banking and money transfers. And the first, Mr. Peterson, I believe, was testifying that he suffered a significant regulatory burden from being under the banking laws, and this is designed to correct that. Can somebody say yes or no?
Mr. Schmidt, DBS director, are you on the line, and did you hear that question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. If I may, through the chair, the answer to Representative Prox's question is that Mr. Peacock operates a small local-based money transfer business that is at a competitive disadvantage to larger money transmitters, but neither Mr. Peacock's business nor PayPal nor Venmo nor Cash App, none of those are banks. I can elaborate on the question further if the representative thinks it might be helpful.
Mr. Schmidt, why don't you go ahead and define a bank for us? Thank you.
All right. We regulate financial institutions. Those fall into two big categories. First is depository financial institutions. Those are banks and credit unions. Those are places where you can go and deposit your paycheck. You can get loans. Those are banks and credit unions. Then we regulate non-depository financial institutions. Some of those include payday lenders, mortgage lenders. They also include money transmission. Money transmission is not the depositing and holding of money or the taking out of loans. It is the transmission of money from one person to another. So about two-thirds of money transmission is sending money from one person to another. Say I want to buy a desk off of Facebook from my examinations chief, Tracy Reno. I can use PayPal to send her $50 for that desk. And it goes from my bank account into PayPal. PayPal then transmits it to Ms. Reno's bank account, or puts it on it. It transmits the money to Ms. Reno. That's two-thirds of it, sending money from point A to point B, from a customer to a merchant, between father, son, as a gift, what have you. But it's the sending of money from one person to the other. Most of the rest of what is regulated as money transmission is prepaid stored value cards. And the best example of that is you go into a grocery store in pretty much any of the bigger towns in Alaska, and you'll see the Visa cards by the checkout stand. And you can grab one of those Visa cards, and you can go to the person, the cashier in the grocery store, and you can put $50 or $100 or $500 or whatever amount on it, and then that money is stored on that card, and that can be then used by whomever holds the card to buy and pay for things. So none of these services are banks. They're all in the business of getting money from one person to another, and it's an industry that has absolutely exploded in the last, really, 5 years.
So to Mr. Schmidt, to clarify there, your Venmo or your, what was the other example? Your PayPal.
Cash App.
Or Cash App, what have you. You may have an account balance there. They may be holding money for you. But is the difference that the money that they hold for you, they have to actually have on hand, whereas a deposit in a bank is essentially a loan to the bank?
That is absolutely one of the differences, yes. They are also subject to different regulation. The way we regulate banks is different from the way we regulate money service businesses. We do perform examinations on both, but they're regulated differently. Banks and credit unions are eligible for insurance through the FDIC or the NCUA. Money service businesses are not, although, and we're starting to get into the deep water and the complexities of the modern financial system. Some money service businesses are teaming with banks to hold customer funds, so that you might think that you're dealing with a business like a PayPal or a Venmo or a Cash App, and you have money on tap with them, but in fact it's being held behind the scenes at a federally insured bank, or sometimes not at a federally insured bank. But this does certainly suggest the complexity of the arrangements that we are seeing in the financial services space. But the most the place where this issue is brought into greatest relief, or it's the clearest, is the proliferation of mobile payment applications on smartphones. What has really, really revolutionized this space is the ability to send and receive money instantly or nearly instantly through smartphone applications like PayPal, like Venmo, like Cash App.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Does anybody else have a question? Representative Prox.
Yes, the cryptocurrencies were mentioned as part of this bill, and I think the bill specifically states that they are not legal tender. Can you explain sort of the background of that part of the bill?
Through the chair, the current law says that there is money, and money is something that is issued by the government, but that money transmission includes both money and monetary value. And monetary value is defined under the current statute as being a broader representation of value that does not necessarily have to be money. It is through that distinction that the Division of Banking and Securities adopted a regulation effective on January 1st, that said money transmission includes cryptocurrency even though it is not issued by a government. What this bill will do that the current law does not already do is it will require certain disclosures for cryptocurrency exchanges. It will require certain financial liquidity standard that will require that cryptocurrency exchanges are subject to financial metrics that other money service businesses are subject to. And it will disclosures, the financial metrics, and it will contain, it contains consumer protection provisions relative to the ownership of cryptocurrency by the account holder and not by the exchange.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Are there other questions?
I don't even know the question to ask. I'll just have to ponder that a lot.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, that concludes our business for today. We will adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:32 p.m.